Welcome, everybody, to the first edition of the Rugby League European Federation podcast of 2021. And joining us today is George Stylianos, a long-term stalwart of Greek Rugby League. George, happy new year to you.
Happy new year, Graham. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, glad you can join us. Whereabouts in Greece are you joining us from, George?
So, Athens. I've been here since 2008.
2008, okay. So the very first question I always ask somebody is, what is your very first personal memory of rugby league?
Yep, so growing up in Brisbane, Australia, obviously rugby league's kind of everywhere. So it's hard to narrow down one particular moment, but one, there's a photo of me actually. I would have been about 4 years old at a Broncos game, Brisbane Broncos, with my dad and my brothers. I was holding the Broncos flag. So I don't know if I actually remember it or if it was constantly seeing that photo when I was growing up that it sort of imprinted in my memory. But I'd say that's probably one of the earliest memories. And, you know, beyond that, just, you know, playing in the backyard with my brothers, playing in the schoolyard and watching on TV, especially State of Origin.
Sure. Tell us then, who's your favourite all-time Broncos player?
I've probably got two. I was a huge fan of Alan Langer, Alfie, growing up, yep. And also a bit later on after him, Shane Webke.
All right, two very different. One, as you say, the orchestrator of the team. Another one of the hard men, the real do the hard yards, Shane Webke.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay. So obviously you grew up with the game, you know, as you say in Brisbane, it just is part of the sporting landscape there for sure. But tell me, just how did you get yourself then? What took you to Greece? Give us the background to that journey.
Okay, so my parents are Greek, and they brought us over here a few times when we were kids. And I got a taste for it, and I got kind of, I'd even say, obsessed with it. And growing up, I said to my parents, half joking, half seriously, I said, oh, when I grow up, I'm going to move back to Greece, and, you know, I just love it there. And yeah, it turns out 2008, I'd actually just finished my degree at university, which was business and marketing. I basically said it's a crossroad, it's a now or never, because if I go into the workforce, before you know it, you're chasing promotions, this, that, and there's kind of, it becomes harder to sort of break that cycle. But then at the time I thought, I've just finished my degree, I've literally got nothing holding me back. So I went for it, literally a one-way ticket. I worked a summer job that first summer on the island of Karpathos, which is between Crete and Rhodes. And then I did my military stint for 3 months because it's still mandatory if you're a Greek male citizen. And then I've been in Athens ever since I got out of the army.
Okay. So did you have family to be part of when you went back to Greece?
I don't have immediate family here. They're all back in Australia, so I'm kind of the black sheep in that way. But I've got a lot of extended family in Greece, in Athens and in the village in southern Greece. I've got a few scattered all over, which I, you know, I'm in contact with, but I don't see all that often.
Okay. So, you know, your love of rugby league growing up in Brisbane is not going to go away. And no doubt, whilst in Greece, you followed it from afar, the fortunes of Brisbane Broncos and the State of Origin. How did you get yourself, you know, actually before that, did you ever see yourself then getting involved in rugby league once you went to Greece? Was that part of when you went
actually,
over there?
Yeah, so you probably know this, that the efforts to start Greek rugby league, they date back to 2003. So it was, the two main guys were Steve Georgalis, who's now an NRL assistant coach, and Terry Liberopoulos, who are based in Sydney. They got something started that was Australia-based. 2006, they played a match against Serbia in Athens. They had a mixed half Aussie, half local players from rugby union, actually. And then they had a few games, I think, in 2008. I think it was in Australia. There was a game on Rhodes at some point. I was doing my best to follow that from afar. I was checking up on them online and stuff, but never really had any contact with them. And it was always on my mind to start something up, but I thought, you know, I don't really have any contacts yet. I'm sort of just still getting settled or established in Greece. I thought, I don't want to, you know, try it alone. You know, I need some help. And then after a while, if I don't know if I'm going too far with the story now, but I'll tell you how things progressed from there. 2011, I was working my job at the time, which was at a hotel reception. And it was a bit quiet at the time, and I was sitting there pondering life, as you do. And that was also when sort of social media was starting to take off. So if you wanted to start a website before then, you had to think about costs. You needed a bit of tech know-how and all this. Whereas suddenly with social media, you could have an online presence, you know, in a couple of minutes. So I thought, I'll put up this page. I initially called it Athens Rugby League. And I said, I put up this big description in Greek and English. And I said, we've got two teams. We're starting early next year, the competition. And then after those two teams, we'll look to, you know, sort of grow into something bigger. It was all fantasy. You know, I just wanted, you know, it was the hope that if someone's browsing and they see it, they're more likely to want to get involved if they think it's, you know, it exists and it's ready to go than if I put a message saying, can you help me? I'm trying to start something. So I thought that would look a bit more appealing. Mm-hmm. A few months went by, and late in the year, a guy named Tassos got in touch with me, and he told me he used to be involved in rugby union and he had a bit of a fallout. He was disgruntled. He said he'd love to try rugby league, and he said he had a few, I think it was three players coming with him. And if we could, you know, collaborate, join forces. And for me, that was a godsend, because, you know, I had literally, it was just me. So I said, sounds great. Count me in. And then we started, you know, having little training sessions. You know, those three players grew to five, grew to 10. And then we eventually, you know, made a team. The first team was called Prometheus. Mm-hmm. And then once that grew big enough, we split it into two. I remember actually our first, what we would call a match, was 7 against 7. And it was essentially that same team split into two. And I think realistically, when you're starting from zero, that's kind of the way it has to be done. So that was kind of the early days. So that's early 2012 now. That's how it kind of all got started.
So really, absolute grassroots, you know, just putting yourself out there and seeing if people are interested. And what was, I'm always fascinated by then, is players, particularly from rugby union, come along. You watch them sort of discover the same sort of love of it as you have. You know, in terms of they get their hands in the ball far more often, they get to make tackles, they get to be part of a more fluid game. Is that the same sort of things that you saw as people begin to sort of have their eyes opened almost?
Yeah, a lot of people tell me that. But I have to say, those three blokes who initially came, and I wouldn't call them rugby union players, they haven't been playing for very long. Yeah. Everyone we've found after that was literally from zero. They didn't know what league or union or American football was. And that's pretty much been our recruitment ever since. Not deliberate. You know, we've got nothing against rugby union. Anyone who wants to join us is welcome. And there is a little bit of crossover. We have a few dual code players in Greece, but it's never been our strategy to go target or headhunt or poach these players. So, a lot of most of our players have come from zero, and it does take a bit longer to teach them a game and develop them and all that. But I really believe long term that it's the best approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people would agree with that. So what has been the feedback that why people have enjoyed it? Because it's a pretty physical game to make as you're sort of maybe regular sport if you haven't been involved in such physical games, you know, before that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's part of the appeal. I think everyone has a different reason why they love it. So about 10 years ago, I don't know if this was just a phenomenon in Greece or if it was worldwide, but contact sports, mixed martial arts, UFC and all that was kind of flavor of the month. And I feel like we rode a bit of the wave of that. So, you know, tough contact sport, A lot of people were drawn to it like that. We had a lot of former kickboxers and that getting involved, so that was good. I know for others, a lot of the appeal is the community. Like since then, we've built such a vibrant community, and people love, you've suddenly got this whole new network of friends. Other people love the fair play of it all, that you don't back chat to the ref, that you leave it on the field. If there's a grudge, you don't continue afterwards with it. The physicality, as always, as I said, is a big one. And again, this social media generation, some of them, for better or for worse, want to show off to their friends and, have pictures of them holding a rugby ball and getting tackled and all this. So that's another thing. People often complain about we're an unknown sport and we got no publicity and all that. And that is true. But in that, there is a bit of opportunity, because I know a lot of people get a kick out of telling people that, oh, did you know I play rugby league? It's a bit, exotic or something. And, if someone's doing it to show off or to whatever, I really don't care, as long as he's playing and, he's turning up and he's committed. Whatever motivates him, I try and find each person's buttons and push them. If that's what motivates them, okay, that's good, go for it. As long as you're being a team player and, all your commitments and all that. So I think our sport has a lot of a really broad appeal and can attract, a vast array of people.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. So you got that first phase out the way, and you talked there about your first real match was obviously a seven-a-side, and you talked about you get your first club and then you split in half because you need eventually to have competition. So take us into 2012 and how you kept the momentum going.
Yep. So 2012, we stagnated a bit. So after that first match, our numbers stayed steady between, I'd say, 15 and 20 players. It wasn't until early 2013, Tassos, who was well connected, put me in touch with a guy at a club called Pegasus, which was in a completely different part of Athens. And he said to me, if you're interested, go there. They've got a field. See if you can start a new team up. And I said, okay, that's not far from where I live. I'll do that. I'll organize training on Friday nights so it doesn't clash with these trainings we have here, and we'll see what happens. And I remember going to that field every Friday night for about 2 or 3 months until I finally found the first player. And that player has gone on. His name's Johnny. Yanis. Nickname is Johnny. He's gone on to play for the national team. He's, I don't want to go off topic here. He's now the coach of the team. He's done really well. And one of the biggest thrills I get is seeing someone go from brand new, never touched, a stadium in their life, to, playing for your country, becoming a coach, completely embracing the sport. So we eventually got the Pegasus team started. Nowadays, they're called the Attica Rhinos. And then we started actually a social media campaign that went a little bit viral. And we had a bit of a surge in playing numbers. So we started two more clubs at that time. One was Aris Petropolis. And the two that we'd initially split, who were barely, seven players each, they became full teams as well. And not long after that, Rhodes, who till then was a rugby union club, joined our rugby league. So then for the 2013/14 season, we were up to five teams.
Great. Okay. I mean, those are great journeys to see when you talked about Johnny there. To be there is discovery of rugby league, to then, as you say, wear the shirt and go on and be the coach of the national team. That's really so satisfying for yourself.
Yeah, big time. And I should just clarify, he coaches our club team now, which is Attica Rhinos, and he plays for the national team. So, but yeah, not just him. There's been other cases similar to that. It's really rewarding. And that field that we started at, we were there for our first 2 years, and I'm not kidding, it's the size of a tennis court. And these are one of the things that, I'm sure it's not just unique to Greece, but a lot of us are dealing with, that there's a real lack of facilities and you've just got to make do with what you can. And we were training for 13-a-side full field matches on that field. So it's not ideal, but, you know, as they say, where there's a will, there's a way, and we made it work somehow.
Oh, listen, I can remember taking London Broncos Academy training on tennis courts in the middle of winter because the pitches weren't available. So pitches, always, it happens all over Europe without a doubt. So yeah,
I'm surprised it happens in England, actually, to be honest.
Well, trust me, it was only a few months, but we had to. It was all we had.
Okay.
So you've worked up, you know, momentum, five teams after a couple of years at it. So what comes next?
So end of 2014, things were going great. We played the Eurogroup C against Czech Republic. We beat Czech Republic and Malta, and then we played the Balkan Cup against Bosnia and Serbia, mm-hmm. and we won both those matches.
And were they the opening internationals in that period, or was there some in 12 and 13?
So we played one at the end of 2013. Right. It was against Hungary, and we used, because it was just a friendly match, we used half, I think it was 9 heritage players and 8 domestic players. Right. Whereas 2014, it was our first time in organized competition. So we had to, for the Malta and Czech Republic match, we had to use a maximum of 4 heritage players.
Yep.
And then for the Serbia trip, they let us, because we had an agreement with Serbia, they let us take some, I think, 8 or 9 Aussies over.
Okay. Okay. So how does a lot of countries have been through this period of combining heritage and domestic players. What was the successes and what were the challenges of that in Greece's situation?
I guess the success of it is the immediate, you know, the short term, you know, you've got less experienced players playing with experienced players, you know, they're being shown the way, showing the right way to play, the right habits and all that. The challenge, I suppose, is always getting the balance right. In the Euro competitions, we don't have a choice because there's the quota, and I'm a big fan of the quotas that, you know, gives, I suppose, countries a motivation to develop their domestic leagues and their players. And then, as you know, as you climb up to World Cup and that, it becomes a bit, I think it's unlimited once you get to World Cup. So it's one of those endless debates. I'm always trying to push the cause of the domestic players as much as I can, because I know pretty much every decision I make, I try and think of the long term. You know, I know that if you want to win a match tomorrow, the quick fix and the temptation is to bring in heritage players. I think if you want to build for the future, you should tip the scales a bit more towards the domestic players wherever you can.
Sure. And is it also about trying to make the national team staff aware of that balance that needs to be struck every time?
Yeah, so we're really lucky because we've got Steve Georgiou, who, as I said, he's not one of these, he has coached NRL, but he's not one of these coaches that have been parachuted in, like, for example, Brad Fittler at the last World Cup, you know, had no previous involvement, you know, with Lebanon. But Steve Georgiou has been at it literally since day one. He gets it. I think his values are exactly the same as ours. So he's always mindful of that. He is a coach. He does want to win the match, but he also shares our philosophy of building for the future. That being said, I've seen a lot of previous World Cups where, you know, a team, not singling anyone out, because many, many countries have done this. They've gone into a World Cup with, I'm sure, all the good intentions to give some local players a run, and it just hasn't happened for whatever reason. And I believe it's, you know, that quick fix sort of, we want to get the win, let's choose our best 17 players. And that's, I guess, the coach's decision. So, what I said to Steve, we actually had a good chat about this time last year, or I think it was just after we qualified. I said, let's not fall into that same trap. Let's agree on a quota now. You know, we had a long discussion about this, and let's announce it. So we're committing ourselves to it, and so that we can't back out last minute or come match day, you know, the temptation is there to play extra heritage players and you take it, as many coaches do. So we settled on the number 16. Our heritage quota would be 16, which, if you know rugby league, as you do, 17 play on match day. Okay. So we figured that with that number, there will be no match without, you know, at least one domestic player. And, you know, some might still say, okay, that's not enough, but it is our first World Cup. We are coming up against the hosts, England, France, Samoa. So we do need a bit of balance. You know, hopefully as the years roll on and as future World Cups, hopefully we're qualifying for them all, you know, that number can decrease and, you know, we start to get more domestic players in there. But it needs time and, as you say, needs a bit of a balance as well. And we feel for our situation that that's the right balance for this year's World Cup.
I think, George, you touched on something there. You need to define success. And I think the fact that if we got to the quarterfinals of the World Cup, that'll mean rugby league in our country will get better. I don't think there's necessarily a direct correlation there. I think you get, for a period, higher attention, perhaps, from your own domestic media and a real good feel factor. But the reality is probably in a year's time or after that, it's not necessarily had the effect. Whereas, as what you're planning to do, take a number of domestic players who can then take back that energy, knowledge, motivation back into their own domestic territories. So I think what you're highlighting there is define what success is as Greek Rugby League for the long term and stick to that plan.
That's right, yeah. And I would actually go a step further. You said quarterfinals. I think World Cup participation, as amazing as it's going to be, on the home front, we are still going to struggle for any shred of publicity. And I think a lot of people don't realize that, because a lot of people, they kind of said to me, oh, congratulations, you made the World Cup. That's great. You know, the as if to say the battle is over and you've reached the promised land and everything's going to be easy now. That's not the case. And I guess you can ask any of those countries, you know, except the tier one nations, about last World Cup, and they'll probably tell you the same thing. You know, they've played in maybe more than one World Cup by now, some of them, and the difference it's made back home has been minimal. You know, it's not going to magically happen. And I've been taking steps as much as I can to try and, you know, find ways to get media exposure and all that. For example, when I watch the Greek news at night, whenever they say we're going to cross to our correspondent in the UK, I've been writing names down so that when the time comes, I'll get in touch with some of them and, you know, maybe give them free tickets or something, or just any scrap of publicity we can get will be great. But I know it's not going to be given to us on a platter. We're still going to have to fight for it. So I'm ready for that.
Sure. Okay. No doubt you will be. So just keep us going on this journey then. You've taken part in your first Euro structured championship, which is another milestone. What follows come 2015?
2015. So again, domestic was peaking. We had five teams. We had one that two teams merged. They were the initial two teams that started, Prometheus and AEK Kokkinas, they were called. But we had a new one emerge in Western Athens called Pirichios. So we still had five teams. Things were going quite well, but cracks were starting to appear. The administration was having constant, I guess, battles with, you know, clubs, with individual players, with coaches, and all sorts of things. And it eventually led to a few of the clubs withdrawing altogether after a long time negotiating, discussing, trying to find a solution. It lasted, I'd say, all in all, about 6 months. And then finally, when they were fed up, and I say they, but I was a part of that, of course, we withdrew. So three of the five clubs staunchly withdrew. One club was undecided and one club stayed. So that's what we call the split. That was, I think, April or May in 2015. And that's when we started, even though there was no federation, and there still is no federation of rugby league in Greece today, we at the time were branded the Rebels, because the committee we had at the time to establish a federation was recognized by, you know, RLEF, the International Federation, and so on. So doing that, you know, we tried to make a complaint to the RLEF, and we tried to do everything as correctly and as by the book and as ethically as possible. But in things like that, there sometimes is no easy way to do it.
Sure, yeah. And I can recall being on the board at that time of the European Federation that, you know, Danny was advising us that there was a split. And we tried to work through, you know, government political channels to sort things out. And as you say, you know, you negotiated, you tried to put it back together, but there's points where you had to sort of take a stand. So just give us some of the things that you and, you know, the clubs had to do to keep things going.
Well, yeah, to keep it going, again, we were trying to work with the European Federation, and they understandably were committed to the old administration, and they had to go through processes and so on. So they ended up opening a one-year investigation. So while all that was happening, we kept going. We tried to start a fourth club so we could have a four-team league the following year. We played an unofficial grand final, actually, because we knew who the top two teams were. So in Rhodes in June of that year, so 2 months after the split, we played a grand final, an unofficial one. And then the following season, because we take our summer break July, August, then we start again in September. We started four teams. We started the Athens Raiders. They didn't last the season. They played about half the season and then withdrew because of lack of playing numbers. So we essentially had three clubs going. And that was really hard because you could say my morale was at rock bottom, but not only did I have to get myself up and keep going, I had to get these three teams worth of people, you know, get them up and believing that there was light at the end of the tunnel and that we're going somewhere and we're not just playing these pointless games. We're keeping it going, but we're building towards something. So all sorts of things. I mean, you've probably read in the press about we had to duck and weave around the authorities quite a bit. All sorts of things along the way.
Yeah, just give us the clarity on that, because there's a bit of mythology or about, you know, midnight games and police turning up. What's the reality, George? Because you're obviously there.
Yeah, okay, you're right. There has been a lot of, I say, mythology is a good word to use it. Or, you know, the legend has grown over the years. Part of that's our fault. We were, I guess, embarrassed to talk about this publicly because you're trying to attract players, which is hard enough as it is, and you don't want to be telling them, or you don't want them saying to you, oh, I saw online that, you know, you guys got shut down, or, you know, the police are after you, or this sort of thing. So we kept it all quiet, and that's how, I guess, these stories got a bit out of control. So the midnight match, what happened there was we had Rhodes coming to visit, and it must have been a few months after the split, at the start of that new season. So it was still fairly fresh. And a lot of the grounds we used to play at used to be arranged by our old friend who was involved in the split. So they were then contacted saying, these people are illegal, they're unauthorized, don't give the field to them. So publicly owned fields, which are usually the best ones that exist, were definitely off limits because we were nobodies. We had no paperwork. We weren't aligned to anything resembling a federation or anything. Private fields were our only hope. A few of them got contacted and were told not to give us the field. And a lot of these people, they hear, you know, are illegal, unauthorized, and they say, look, we don't want any trouble. Okay, whatever. We're not going to give them the field. And they don't even want to hear our side of the story. Luckily, we found one field and time wasn't on our side because Rhodes had booked their flights, they'd booked everything. There was no backing out. It had to be played that day. So we found one field that we used to play at. We still do, actually, deep in the industrial zone of Athens. And he said, look, I'll give you the field. I don't mind, but I'm fully booked with soccer games until 11 p.m. And we said, look, that's fine. We'll take it. I mean, you know, at that time, a lot of our teams were training at 10:30 or 11 o'clock, starting training. So it wasn't that bad at all. So we said, oh, that's a godsend. We have to play the match that day. We'll take it. We get to the field that day. And sure enough, the matches before us were running late. They said, oh, you're going to get on at 11:30. Don't worry. Sure enough, those matches didn't end till 12. So by the time we got on, had the warm-up and so on, the match kicked off. I remember recording it. It was 12:15 and it finished at 1:47. So as far as I know, that's a world record in a sense.
So we played on a different date even.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. But, you know, if it was two Athens teams, we would have simply said, okay, let's find another day or another weekend to put the game on. But Rhodes had booked tickets. They were arriving that day, flying out the next day. So it had to be played that day. So, and we were left with one field in all of Athens. So that's how we ended up playing a midnight game. And again, we're lucky it's in an industrial zone because we had no neighbors complaining about noise or the bright lights still being on or anything like that. So we were lucky in a way, I suppose.
Okay, so the reality is the game did take part after midnight, but it wasn't quite because you were trying to avoid the authorities, albeit it was made difficult for you to find a field. That would be the summary of the situation.
Yeah, exactly. It just so happened that way. Yeah. And we ended up, when we eventually did announce that, we ended up kind of, I guess, exploiting it to our... Because when things were progressing and nothing was happening, after a long time keeping these things hush-hush, we eventually, you know, put out these bits of, you know, information about the police turning up and about the midnight match. And again, it's our fault that rumors got out of hand because we didn't fully clarify what happened, but that's what happened in its fullness.
So, I mean, it seems there's a bit of a classic situation where there's a lot of people who just want to get on and play and get on with the really important stuff, playing and coaching and everything. But the administration, and obviously, I mean, you'll know more about it, but we got to the situation where Greek modern pentathlon was where rugby league was housed administrative-wise, and you couldn't think of a less likely colleague sport, you know, to put rugby league with, whether exactly. It be from there's no horses in rugby league, and just from a social economic point of view as well, totally different culturally. So there must exactly. have been some great camaraderie, though, and sense of belief and desire for those of you who were just wanting to get on and play and make a difference. It must have kept you going through some pretty difficult times.
Definitely. And it's funny that you say that, because for me personally, what's kept me going all these years is that, you know, I mean, 99% of my friends, you know, in Greece are from rugby league. So, and I just love them. They're just such great guys. And if they weren't, I probably wouldn't have stuck around, because they're worth fighting for. That's what I can say. And they're a big reason why I stayed on. The thought crossed my mind many times to just walk away or to quit or to cut my losses. And it still does from time to time, but I'm glad I hung in there.
Sure. Absolutely. No, I think, you know, not everyone's necessarily been through that same administration politics nightmare almost, but there will be times when people, the vast majority, like yourselves, volunteers who think, you know, I'm giving a lot here. And is it being appreciated? And is it being valued to me? So I think that's a very honest but very open thought that lots of people have over the years. But as you say, there's something that keeps you in there, whether it be the game itself, the journey, the people around it. And of course, you did come through that, and you've continued to make progress.
Yeah. Again, it's one of those feelings you feel a bit vindicated, but. I feel like we've still got a long way to go, but things now are looking so much better than they were, you know, even 12 months ago.
Sure. So just give us, before COVID struck, you know, that period, so around about, you know, last 2 or 3 years, what was the state of play in Greek Rugby League in terms of number of clubs and so on?
So things were going really well. So we had, I think it was 19 games in the last, I think it was a 5-month period before COVID shut us down. So that was, things were going well. We had 7 teams at the time, and we had 3 women's teams. They don't have a full 13 yet, but they play usually nines matches amongst themselves. And I'm really proud to say we had three players homegrown playing in French Elite 2 as well. So I put that down as another, you know, big success of ours that we've managed to not just produce quantity, but also a few quality players that have tried their luck abroad and succeeded.
And that's an invaluable pathway, isn't it? You know, for somebody, you know, be introduced to the game domestically, to know they can go and make a living and see another part of the world. So while some people say, oh, it's disappointing to lose players, the reality is it's a pretty good recruitment tool, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. We need to, I guess, as we get more developed, I'd like to put something more of a structured pathway in place. But because a lot of these guys have literally gotten up and gone and had nothing more than a trial or a training session promised to them. And Stefanos Bastas, who played for Doncaster in 2019, he really was the trailblazer of that. He believed in himself. He got up and went. And I suppose the fact that he succeeded over there got the others believing that, you know, I've played alongside him. I know what his ability is. I'm not that far off. Maybe I can try it as well. And the fact that he did succeed, you know, it helped us a lot as well, because over the years, I've contacted coaches abroad and all this, sent videos of players. Will you give this guy a shot? Will you give him a trial? And sometimes you don't get a response. Sometimes you get they politely decline. Sometimes, you know, you get even laughed at. The fact that Stefanos went over and sort of paved the way and showed that, okay, Greeks are there and they're playing rugby league and it's not a joke, the response we get now is completely different. They do take us seriously, and sometimes they approach us, which is really good. Yeah. Like I say, only three have done it so far, but I'm sure in the coming years we'll get a few more over as well.
Yeah. And we've touched upon it already, the 2021 World Cup. But talk us through the qualification, because, you know, every country who's in the qualifying enters it with the hopes of making it. Obviously, the World Cup's gone from 14 to 16 teams, and that produced another slot for a European nation to qualify in 2021. What was that journey like, the qualification one?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. So we started off in Group C with Malta and Ukraine. Now, during this whole time, we were still quote unquote illegal in Greece, because we were unauthorized, we didn't have a federation, and we had this enemy, let's say, doing everything he could to stop our matches and so on. So when we hosted Malta, we were lucky to find a field on the outskirts of Athens, and we were lucky that despite we've got quite a good relationship with rugby union here, even though we don't have much crossover with our players, actually, maybe that's the reason we do have a good relationship. They found us a field, they agreed to keep it hush-hush and everything. So we actually told no one. I think there were about five people in the whole of Greece on match day that knew where the match was being played. So I was responsible for showing the Malta team around Athens, taking them to training, to their meals, to all that. And they were asking me, oh, where's the field? What's it called? And I said, guys, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. Just, you know, be ready at 11 or 12 or whatever it was, midday. The bus will pick you up. I'll be there with you. We'll take you to the field. Don't ask any more questions. And players in the Greek national team were told the same thing. They were given a meeting point. They said, be there at this time. Get on the bus. Don't ask any more questions. We'll tell you the venue, if you want to tell your parents and that so they can come watch. We'll tell you 1 hour before the match. That'll give them just enough time to get there, because it really is a small community, and someone could unwittingly, or they tell that person and then it gets passed on. And before you know it ends up in the wrong hands, because there was a real threat of the police shutting that match down, because we were supposedly the imposters posing as the Greek national team. So luckily that match got played. without interruption, a very small crowd because of the circumstances. And then we played the match in Ukraine, and we actually won that by the skin of our teeth, 28-26. So people, we're in the World Cup now, but people don't realize in Kharkiv, Ukraine, 3 years ago, we were that close to elimination. It could have all been over before we even progressed to the latter stages of qualification.
Well, I tell you what, I can guarantee you one thing is that John Dutton won't be keeping quiet your venues when Greece plays at the World Cup, like you had to your opening game. I think it'll be completely the opposite, I have to say.
I'm glad.
The boys won't be getting on the bus and being told, well, you'll find out the venue is when we
get there. That's right. It'll be a rare treat for us.
But that's just a great journey, isn't it? To think that's, you know, again, that was your starting point now where you've landed. So, you know, telling you, obviously, you then played further games. And what about the qualifying? What about the moment you knew you were going?
After that, we had to play Norway. We played a one-off match in London. We won that, luckily. And then we had to play in a group of three at the end where two would progress to the World Cup. So we had Scotland and Serbia. So Scotland was our first match, again, played in London. That was our home match, but we didn't want to risk. We took no chances. So we played that. We forfeited basically our right to play at home, played that in London. We lost by a respectable scoreline, 42-24. Yep. And then a week later, we played Serbia in Belgrade. So we essentially had two away matches. And that ended up being a blowout scoreline. We had, against Scotland, we had four domestic players playing. And in Serbia, admittedly, we had three. So Serbia scored in the opening, I think, 8 seconds. It was a world record try. They kicked off. It was high and short. It bounced into the player's arms and he scored. And then we ended up, I think it ended up being 82-6 or something. So it ended up being a real rout, I guess.
Yeah.
So the feeling for me personally, not being a player, I was watching from the grandstand. I was happy, but I sort of knew at halftime that we were through.
Yeah.
So it was a bit less, I guess, you know, emotional and all that, but seeing the players, how happy they were, how emotional some of them were. And, you know, the coaches and Terry Liberopoulos, guys who have been at it since day one. That was really special and really rewarding, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, if you talked about Steve, the coach there, going back to 2003, that's nearly a 20-year journey to get to the, you know, the greatest pinnacle of our sport, the World Cup. But, you know, for yourself, you'll be on a 10-year journey. Take yourself forward, just over 10 months, actually. How do you think you'll feel when you look back and think, oh, I'm in a World Cup match with Greece, and 10 years ago I was sending out on a website, you know, saying, come and join Greek Rugby League, when there wasn't really one?
Yeah, well, when you put it like that, it is pretty remarkable, and it hasn't hit me at all yet, and I guess I won't know until that time. But yeah, look, if no one in the world knows my name or you know what it took to get us to that point, I'll still just be happy, even if I'm sitting up in the nosebleed section watching Greece run out and a lot of heads turning saying, oh wow, Greece play rugby league, wow, you know, that'll give me a lot of satisfaction. And again, it'll give me more satisfaction if we can find a way, which I still haven't found, to make, you know, to ride that wave of momentum and build the game stronger here in Greece as well.
Yeah. Well, listen, George, I think it'll be a great moment for the sport to welcome Greece into the Men's World Cup for its debut. And, you know, we're seeing that also with the likes of Spain and Norway in the wheelchair, you know, Jamaica as well in the men's. You know, so just fantastic when it happens. And it is fascinating for people, and this is the whole point of these podcasts, is to hear the journey to that point, you know, the very grand moment, the very, you know, which we broadcast around the world, but there's so many great moments along that journey. And even if you just look at, you say, the World Cup qualifying, 28-26 in Ukraine, you know, that must have been one of those that went down to the wire, no doubt. And that could have been so different. But the fact is, you came through that, and that now you'll be there. So it's really fantastic to hear about your journey. George, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Excellent. Listen, folks, that wraps us up into our first interview of 2021. No doubt, we all thought perhaps the world would be a little bit different by now compared to when we started these podcasts in around about April, with COVID still very much dominant, unfortunately, but with a vaccine on the way. So as ever, we wish you health, you, yourself, your families, and the rugby league communities, and we'll be back with you in a couple of weeks' time. Thank you.